Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Crystal, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And I also just want to call out there are two specific colorectal cancer organizations that have partnered with us as well, which are maybe familiar to many of you, the Colon Cancer Alliance and Fight Colorectal Cancer. And that information is available to you both on the brochures, but also will be available to all of you after the program, of course, in the evaluations that you'll be receiving. Now, today's program, we have lots of you on the program today. It's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend today this hour with us. We have over 553 participants on the program today, so there are a lot of you on the call. Even though you can't see each other, just to be aware that there's a very large group of you listening. And you come from all over the United States, and really primarily from the United States. And we also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, France, Greece, India, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So it really is a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by a grant from Genentech and Taiho Oncology, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson III. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Cooperative Groups, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to be addressing overview of colorectal cancer, treatment for metastatic refractory colorectal cancer, novel treatment approaches, and predicting response to treatment. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thanks to all of you for joining today. I'm going to be talking about colorectal cancer, and I'm going to try to highlight some of the important aspects of this disease in a relatively short time. So, as you probably all know, colorectal cancer is a very major health problem around the world. In the United States, the lowest risk is seen in Asian Americans, and the highest risk is in African Americans. What we've seen, however, is a declining incidence across all groups, particularly older individuals. However, we are also seeing a rising incidence in younger individuals, meaning those under age 50. And it's not totally clear why, but this is a very real phenomenon that we're going to have to address. One theory is that the natural bacteria in our intestinal tract, which is a very important component of our intestines, has changed. And this may be related to our diet or other environmental factors. But this change in what's referred to as the microbiome may account for some of this increased risk, as well as those who may have an inherited form of cancer. A great deal of research now is focusing on the microbiome so we can better understand this phenomenon. Most people who have a diagnosis of colon cancer present with earlier stages and can undergo successful surgery. However, out of those, unfortunately, there are people who will develop metastatic disease, and this has been a great deal of focus of research. About 20% of people, when they present with colon cancer, already have disease spread to other areas. And most often, liver is the site of spread of the disease. We have identified risk factors that are important, such as diabetes, obesity, where there's increased risk. Also, those who have heavy alcohol use, smoking, a Western diet is associated with increased risk. And currently, there's a great deal of research looking at the role of factors that may be important in terms of risk, such as the amount of exercise a person engages in. We've seen that people with low exercise tend to have higher rates, and also if they have a diagnosis of colon cancer, they may do less well. There's also a great deal of work looking at vitamin D, as well as the role of aspirin, both in terms of prevention, but also if a person has a diagnosis of colon cancer, and what supplementation with these various agents may do to improve outcomes. About 70% of people have what we call sporadic colorectal cancer. That means we haven't identified an inherited risk, but this has occurred related to other factors, perhaps that I just mentioned. About 20% have what we call familial cancer. So we may not have identified a specific inherited link, but for example, one of the highest risk groups is if you have a first degree relative, meaning brother, sister, parents, who were diagnosed under age 45, the risk of developing a colorectal cancer in family members is about 5 times greater. So we are putting a lot of emphasis on people understanding their family history because it can be important and also affect how we screen individuals for colon cancer. One of the most common inherited types of colon cancer is known as the Lynch syndrome, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit further. We also emphasize that if you have a diagnosis, a multidisciplinary team is important. That includes gastroenterologists, pathologists, radiologists, medical oncologists, surgeons, and in some cases, radiation oncologists. So it's important to know who your team is, including other health professionals such as nutritionists, genetic counselors, and nurses as important examples. We have made a lot of progress in caring for people with colorectal cancer. For example, there are now 5 chemotherapy drugs, and in fact, last year the FDA approved the 5th new chemotherapy drug, and we have 6 drugs that we refer to as biologics. And with this collection of 11 drugs now, there are literally hundreds of combinations and sequences that we can utilize to treat our patients. And it's very important to look at each individual to see which combination and sequence might be most beneficial. Now, I want to move a little bit into what's referred to as tumor genetics. You hear a great deal about this, referred to as personalized medicine. And one of the important genetic pathways is referred to as the mismatch repair pathway. And we can actually evaluate this in the laboratory on individual tumor specimens. And you may see a report that'll say a person has microsatellite instability or deficient mismatch repair. These are analyzed separately, but biologically they are the same. And these, what is referred to as microsatellites, are actually short repeating DNA sequences across our human genome. And these sequences tend to be prone to errors, but fortunately, we have genes that can correct these errors and allow for normal DNA replication. When these errors are not corrected, this is what's referred to as mismatch repair. people with microsatellite instability tumors represent about 15% of all people with colorectal cancers. Some of these are actually inherited, which is referred to as having a germline mutation. Others are non-inherited, but there's actually loss of expression of this mismatch repair gene, which predisposes people to developing a colon cancer. And Lynch syndrome is the example of an inherited colorectal cancer where there is this microsatellite instability. We now recommend that all individuals with colon cancer are tested for mismatch repair because it can affect treatment strategies, and certainly if there's suspicion it's an inherited cancer, we need to address that with genetic counseling and also working with other family members if it's proven that it's inherited. Fortunately, most people with mismatch repair tumors actually do very well, but there's a small group of people who can develop metastatic disease. And this group has been an important area of research because this group tends to be very sensitive to immunotherapy. And recent clinical trials with the drugs pembrolizumab and nivolumab, which are immunotherapy drugs, have shown benefit for people with metastatic disease. And so this is an area of intense research and also another important reason to identify people with microsatellite instability tumors. Now, we're also interested in how to help the majority of people who do not have MSI tumors to become more responsive to immunotherapy. And there are combinations with immunotherapy drugs and other biological drugs that target other pathways that can lead to cancer. When given in combination, we are seeing that we can make, at least for some people, their tumors much more responsive to immunotherapy. And this is an advance, and we're waiting for some new clinical trial data, because if these trials reinforce what we've observed in early studies, this could really change our treatment programs. Now, another biological test that's very important for people with metastatic disease is called RAS testing. And about 50% of people will have what's known as a KRAS or NRAS mutation in their tumors. And the reason this is important is that there are two drugs. One is called cetuximab, another panitumumab, and these are in a class of drugs known as anti-EGFR agents, whereby if you do not have a RAS mutation, you are much more likely to get benefit from either cetuximab or panitumumab. If you do have a RAS mutation, you should not receive these drugs. Now, some more recent work, which also applies to the RAS mutation phenomenon, is the difference in outcome between people who have right versus left-sided colon tumors. We've actually known for some time that people with left-sided tumors tend to do better overall and are more responsive to therapy. We weren't really sure why, but what we've learned is that there are important biological differences between tumors on the left versus the right side of the colon. And most recent large clinical trials have shown that people who do not have a RAS mutation and a left-sided colon cancer are much, much more likely to benefit from drugs like cetuximab or panitumumab compared to people with right-sided tumors where there does not appear to be significant benefit. So this is yet another factor we have to consider when we're thinking about treatment strategies for patients. Now, I want to conclude to just say that in terms of how we can predict responses to therapy and developing novel approaches has come from the Cancer Genome Atlas. And in 2012, two big groups of patients were identified. One, the largest group, are those with mutated tumors, compared to another group of hypermutated tumors. And the hypermutated group is predominantly those with microsatellite instability. However, further perfecting these biological differences, in 2015, the consensus molecular subtypes of colorectal cancer were identified. And for these non-hypermutated tumor groups, three other groups were identified, and these can predict outcomes of patients as well as helping to define which treatments might work better for select individuals. And so we're going to need to do a lot more work to design drugs based on this biological understanding and what we hope will lead to even better outcome for our patients. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and thank you all for listening.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was an outstanding presentation on colorectal cancer, and also in terms of treatment of metastatic refractory colorectal cancer. Lots of information for people, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so everybody start getting your questions ready. I know there'll be lots of them. And our next speaker is Dr. Andrea Sersek. Dr. Sersek is assistant attending physician, gastrointestinal oncology service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Sersek is going to address the role of precision medicine in informing treatment, clinical trials, tips to manage side effects, symptoms, and pain, key questions to ask your healthcare team. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sersek.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mesner. It's a pleasure to be here. I will discuss briefly a bit on personalizing treatment and specifically the role of genetic mutations, which Dr. Benson has very nicely already outlined. So we know we have several cytotoxic or intravenous chemotherapies that we can use in colorectal cancer, but knowing the genetic makeup of the tumor is very important because it enables us to combine some of those therapies such as FOLFOX/FOLFIRI with specific targeted agents, and that's exactly what Dr. Benson has outlined. And what personalizing treatment or personalized medicine really is that each tumor, just like each individual, has its own biological makeup. So the tumor itself is made up of many, many, many genes, and some of those genes are altered or what we call mutated and are potentially responsible for causing this tumor to grow. So what we do now as standard of care for all of our patients with metastatic colorectal cancer is we sequence several important genes, some of which Dr. Benson has already discussed, including RAS. And with this sequencing information, we also learn about the mismatch repair proteins, as Dr. Benson has outlined, for the potential of immunotherapy as well as further clinical trials. So what we know from this testing is we look at several different genes. So for the one is RAS, and that Dr. Benson outlined very clearly. There are several RAS genes called KRAS, NRAS, as well as HRAS that all together form the group called RAS genes. And what we do have two drugs that target this these genes specifically. They target the epidermal growth factor receptor. They are cetuximab and panitumumab. But as Dr. Benson mentioned, if a patient has a RAS mutation, and it can be in any of these, in KRAS or NRAS, then we know that these inhibitors do not work. And this is important to know because prior to this knowledge, patients would receive these drugs and have the associated toxicities, which I will discuss in a minute, but would not benefit. So now we know that the only patients with what are called RAS wild-type tumors benefit from this. And furthermore, additionally, we've learned that patients with left-sided tumors do benefit, while those with right-sided do not, as Dr. Benson has already reviewed. So what other markers do we look at beyond RAS in genetic testing? Another important one is BRAF. We've learned that patients with BRAF mutations, those tumors tend to be a bit more aggressive. Not uniformly, there are several different subtypes of BRAF mutations, but those that are V600E mutated tumors tend to be more aggressive, tend to recur after surgery. However, we do have inhibitors that target this gene specifically, and there are several ongoing clinical trials as well as several completed trials looking at combinations of a drug that targets the BRAF gene called vemurafenib with other targeted agents as well as systemic chemotherapy to see if we can improve the outcomes in patients with BRAF-mutated tumors. MSI-high, as Dr. Benson has discussed, is another important area. There is a small subset of patients with metastatic disease that do have microsatellite high or unstable tumors that benefit from immunotherapy, but there are many, many ongoing clinical trials looking at combinations to benefit the large majority of metastatic colorectal cancer patients that do not have these overly or what we call hypermutated tumors to see if we might be able to elicit interest of the immune system and then add immunotherapy to better improve on the response in the majority of patients that are what we call MSS or microsatellite stable. And another active target, which is an active area of research, is the HER2, or the human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, which is a small subset of colorectal cancer patients, 5% or less. However, there have been some early clinical trials that have promising activity utilizing HER2 therapy in combination with other agents. And so this is all very exciting. There are many, many other clinical trials, and I always encourage patients, if standard therapies have been exhausted, to seek clinical trials if they are fit to do so, because there are many exciting new opportunities and new novel combinations that we are testing based on this precision medicine, based on individual genetic tumor genetic signatures to better able target and stop the disease from growing. Our therapies, of course, unfortunately, do bring along several side effects, and I always tell my patients the most important thing to do is to discuss any issues, any questions that might arise with your treating team, with your nurse, with your physician, to really not only to prevent side effects, but also to treat them more effectively and really improve the quality of life. And a lot of side effects can be managed with a dose reduction or perhaps with medications that could really enable one to withstand chemotherapy better and then more importantly also have a good quality of life while on treatment. So just to review some of the main ones, nausea and vomiting is a very common side effect that occurs in a lot of patients, unfortunately, but we do have excellent anti-nausea medications. I always tell my patients to take the medication as soon as you feel queasy, as soon as the nausea begins, not to try to tough it out because then we're playing catch up, and if the vomiting starts, it's much, much harder to do so. But there are a number of agents that we can use in combination. Sometimes they can be straddled to use something every 4 hours, for example, to really better manage the nausea. And of course, if that's not effective, then you can choose to speak with your physician about potentially lowering the dosing of chemotherapy as well. Fever and infections are always, an important thing to look out for. Again, here communication is critical. We consider every low-grade fever an important fever because what can happen is the chemotherapy can affect the white cells, which are the infection-fighting cells. We worry most about infections from bacteria in the bloodstream or in the gut, not so much from colds from other people. So I encourage patients to live their lives and be active, but just to take their temperature if you feel a fever or a chill coming on, and more importantly, communicate with your physician or your treating team. of course, it's not fun to have a fever or, you know, cold on chemotherapy either, so it's always important to use common sense, but people definitely should not limit their activities and their ability to go outside and participate and maintain a good quality of life from that perspective. Anemia can also happen, which is it's a lowering of the red cells. That's, again, something that the physicians will keep a close eye on. Blood clots can occur also with chemotherapy, as well as just having cancer predisposes to developing of blood clots. And that's something that is an important part of a physical exam and relaying any symptoms such as shortness of breath. Calf swelling, for example, commonly a blood clot can develop in the lower legs and the calves. Things of that nature. The chemotherapy can also cause diarrhea and mouth sores known as mucositis, and that's important to discuss with the doctor, as we do have a lot of supportive medications that we can use, including mouth rinse as anti-diarrheal medications, but it's always important to rule out an infection, so that is something that your treating physician can deal with. Some of our targeted agents, as I mentioned, particularly cetuximab and panitumumab that target the EGFR growth factor receptor, can cause a skin rash and nail changes. These can be difficult to tolerate. They can look like a acne rash, and most of the time we can manage these with antibiotics or with certain creams, and it's important to discuss that with the physicians as well, potentially even prophylactically. And then another important one that we can't forget is from oxaliplatin, which is used in the combination with CAPOX, with capecitabine plus oxaliplatin or FOLFOX. It is a good drug. It is an important drug in our treatment repertoire. However, it can cause nerve damage known as neuropathy. There are two types. One is a cold sensitivity that's transient. It lasts usually a few days right after each cycle. It tends to kind of last a bit longer after each cycle. But that one is annoying and difficult to deal with, in that touching cold things, you can feel pins and needles, drinking cold things. The throat is very sensitive, so people sometimes feel almost as if they're choking. Usually we advise to stay away from, to sort of keep food and drink at lukewarm temperature, and then to test things out gradually, as that does tend to go away after a few days. There is a second kind of neuropathy that occurs over time, and that is a numbness or tingling that's not provoked by cold. So patients often notice a slight lack of dexterity. The fingertips don't feel quite as normal as they used to, feel slightly numb, and as do the feet, and that is something that's actually can be quite challenging, because sometimes that doesn't start until the drug is stopped. And so if that is occurring, definitely the most important thing is, again, to communicate with your treating team. And oftentimes we don't give beyond 6 or 8 treatments total in metastatic colorectal cancer of oxaliplatin, because we have learned from studies that if we stop it early and then restart it at a later time if needed, people do just as well, but they have significantly less neuropathy. So again, I think I'll leave it with the most important thing is, just in terms of management of side effects, is good communication with the physician. Make sure that you are relaying what happens. Sometimes it's difficult to remember what happened 2 weeks ago. Sometimes it's a good idea to keep a diary, because our mutual goal is to maintain a good quality of life while still receiving effective treatment.
Thank you so much,
Dr.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stasek. That was really outstanding and very comprehensive, with lots of good tips about managing side effects and symptoms and discomfort, and also to work very closely with the healthcare team. So I know we're going to hear more about that during the Q&A. I know there'll be questions also for Dr. Stasek during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. Ms. Bearden is supervisor of clinical nutrition. She is a nutritionist, a dietitian, at University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's really my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. nutrition and hydration are key to tolerance during treatment and beyond. Nutrition provides you the energy to do the things you enjoy and helps you maintain the muscle mass to have the endurance to also do the things you enjoy. Now, in general, a plant-based diet is the most ideal through all stages of cancer, including prevention, during treatment, and survivorship. That translates into having about two-thirds of your plate from a whole grain. So the least processed, the better. Examples of these would be fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, whole grains, potatoes, those sorts of things. Plant-based foods provide antioxidants and phytochemicals. And we know that our body absorbs these nutrients when coming from food better than when coming from a supplement. So we really want folks to understand how to eat and eat the foods that will provide them nutritive quality. The other third of the plate is recommended to come from a lean protein source. These are things like wild-caught fish, lean poultry, beans. Protein is important because it's the building block for healing and tissue development. It doesn't matter if, dark meat or light meat, light-colored meat. We just want to make sure that you're having a balance between, proteins of all different types. So fish oftentimes will carry healthy fats, such as omega-3s. Poultry, even though dark meat may have more saturated fat in it, we want basically for you to have a balance of both saturated and unsaturated fat in your diet. So more of the unsaturated fat, so more light-colored meat than dark-colored meat, but you're still open to have that. And then all kinds of beans. All beans are good for you. When we think of our plant-based foods, oftentimes fresh becomes the first thing people go to. And sometimes location doesn't allow for that, variety of where you are if you're in a small town. And actually frozen is more nutritionally packed. The reason for that is the food's allowed to completely ripen on the vine or on the tree or wherever it's growing from. And then they harvest it, wash it, and then they blast freeze it. So it's really at its peak. Oftentimes our fresh can come from far away and travel and be picked much sooner than it's ready to be. And so there may be even a flavor difference. During your treatment, there may or may not be a need for you to take supplements. Always talk with your healthcare team before starting a supplement. Supplements oftentimes may be interactive with your treatment, and so you just want to make sure that it's in line with what's best for you. Now, there are times throughout your treatment, we've heard today already, that your diet may have to be modified. If you have GI distress, if you're having intolerance to cold foods, if you're having swallowing problems, chewing problems, at this point, communicate with your healthcare team. That's the best way to do it, to meet your unique needs during your treatment process. It's also mentioned earlier, keeping a diary of your symptoms. Oftentimes, something you may have eaten just didn't agree with you, or maybe that's kind of the culprit, you don't always know, of kind of a continued issue. So keeping a diary of what you're eating and your symptoms when your symptoms arise can be very helpful for the team. Now, hydration is something we oftentimes forget about, but is very important. Dehydration can increase your symptoms of nausea, fatigue, headaches, dizziness. Fluid is anything that is liquid at room temperature. And so this includes things like water, juice, sports drinks. And a general guideline is most people need between 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day, so 64 to 80 ounces. Again, communicating with your healthcare team is the best way to meet your unique needs and whatever your unique plan is for your healthcare in your treatment process. Talking with your team is the best way to go. A dietitian can also help provide not only the diet modifications that may be helpful for you and your tolerance, but also discuss calorie, protein needs, fluid needs for you individually. So that can be oftentimes a question patients come in with. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn, and thanks so much for allowing me to be part of today's presentation.
Thank you so much, Ms. Durden. That was excellent. A lot of good tips for everybody. And there are always questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Thanks so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlin. Ms. Edlin is an oncology social worker, and she is she's our online support group program director at Cancer Care. And Ms. Edlin is going to address the free psychosocial services and programs that you can access from Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Edlin, my esteemed colleague.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. And I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with colorectal cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional supportive services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and their family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online support groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what all of this means for you and your family. A social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. So please do consider contacting us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Edlin. That was wonderful, and as always, and I know there'll be questions for you as well. And we now do have time for questions, so we're going to start with questions. And I'm going to first, some of you have already started posting questions, but I'm going to ask Crystal to go ahead and explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. Everybody can go ahead and post their questions. Yes.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Emil S. Your line is open.
If someone has polyps removed during a routine endoscopy colonoscopy, are they considered precancerous, and is there any way to prevent future polyps from developing? Also, are there less invasive procedures to test for colon cancer besides those two procedures and or using stool cards?
Well, thank you, Emil. That's an excellent question. I'm going to ask if Dr. Benson, if you would address that question, please.
So not all polyps are necessarily destined to become cancers, but certainly if a polyp is identified, they're removed and evaluated under the microscope. Colonoscopy has been the gold standard. However, there are the, as you mentioned, the cards to test for any evidence of bleeding. In addition, often people have had testing that have included those cards and a proctoscopy or flexible sigmoidoscopy, which actually can be done in the office and is not as extensive as a colonoscopy. There's also CT calligraphy, which is evaluating the colon with a CT scan. The issue there, there are several issues actually. One is that the bowel prep is the same as for a colonoscopy, and often people find the preparation the most difficult component of a colonoscopy. And also with CT calligraphy, if an abnormality is identified, a person would still need a colonoscopy to evaluate that abnormality. I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of that.
I think the question was about the polyps themselves. Did you address that already?
Prevention. There is a great deal of interest in prevention. There have been trials looking at non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, particularly for people with an inherited type of colon cancer, familial adenomatous polyposis. And there has been some indication that that can reduce polyps. There are potential risks with non-steroidals such as aspirin, and so people should really discuss the use of such with their gastroenterologist or their primary care doctor. I hope that addresses most of the concerns.
Excellent, thank you. I hope that helps, Emil. If you have a follow-up question, you'll let us know. But okay, and our next question.
Our next question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is open.
Oh, thank you so much, Caroline, Dr. Messner. This is an excellent seminar. Thank you. I have two questions. The first question I have is I was HER2 breast cancer, and my father had colon cancer, metastatic colon cancer. I'm wondering if the HER2 breast cancer is similar to HER2 colon cancer that I could have inherited from him. I have a question with, I was negative, though, with the Lynch breast test. The Lynch blood test, I was negative. And the second question I have is on the vitamin D, what is the good range, the best possible range to keep vitamin D blood level, and what is the amount of aspirin someone should be taking since I've been taking aspirin and I have no more polyps anymore? Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Stephanie, for that question and comments. And I'm going to ask Dr. Sersek if you could address those questions.
Sure. So the first question was regarding the HER2. So the HER2 expression is the same. It is the same pathway. However, it is something that's going on in the tumor only. It's not hereditary. So the difference is the genetic makeup of the tumor itself. So we see HER2 commonly in breast cancer. We see it in gastric cancer. It's much less that the mutation is or the amplification rather is significantly lower in colorectal cancer, but it is there as well. So the drugs and the target is the same, but that's what's going on in the tumor. What happened is for you in terms of inheriting things, that's what's called the germline, and that is not the case. That's what they tested when they looked at for Lynch syndrome and things of that nature. And so we don't think that there's a link between, you know, the different cancers expressing HER2, any genetic link. And what was the second part of the question? Sorry.
So the second part, was about vitamin D levels, that she has had. I guess is there a level of vitamin D that people should be taking, or is that more adapted to the physician and somehow her perception?
We're absolutely repleting vitamin D levels, but I think it depends on your level, and you know, it's something that you should speak to your physician about specifically.
There was actually, a component of that had to do with preventive, is taking vitamin D prevent polyps. I think that was part of it, like her colonoscopies have been less polyps.
Well, yeah, I think she was asking about aspirin and vitamin D.
Oh.
I can just comment on the vitamin D. The problem is that the studies that have been done looked at people's blood levels of vitamin D, and the individuals who had the highest levels tended to do better overall. What we do not know is if you supplement with vitamin D and increase those blood levels, will it have any impact? And so there are continuing prevention trials, as well as people being treated for metastatic disease and looking at different doses of vitamin D to see if there's any impact. But we really don't know.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm so grateful. Thank you. This is a wonderful team. And our next telephone question.
And our next question comes from Joseph M. Your line is open.
Yes. Hi. I was calling to find out if it's would benefit us to. My wife has stage 3 colorectal, recurrent metastatic colorectal cancer. I guess it's stage 4 now. So she initially went with a FOLFOX treatment, and you know, it came back within about 2.5 months. So she's currently undergoing a FOLFIRI treatment with Avastin. She was microsatellite stable, and she also was she wasn't the wild type KRAS. She was, I guess, the mutated, and then I think her BRAS was normal. But my question was, is it? I don't know how far they test with the molecular testing. Is it? You know, I hear of some organizations like Foundation One and some of these other companies that drill down, I guess, a little deeper. Is that something worth looking into, or do you think basically the testing that she may have had is pretty much is what, you know, is what's out there for that would be applicable to her case?
Well, thank you, Joseph. Those are excellent questions. Dr. Benson, would you address these questions in a general way, if you could?
Yes. Yeah, so it sounds like the appropriate standardized genomic testing was done with important information. We are looking at more comprehensive genomic testing, and you mentioned one company, Foundation Medicine, but there are a number of companies now that do this work, and many cancer centers do their own genomic testing and create profiles. It's been a challenge in colorectal cancer because often when we get these reports back, we do not find what's called an actionable mutation, meaning we cannot link a genomic test result with a treatment that is linked to that abnormality. However, sometimes we can, as long as people understand that there may be no benefit from doing the test, but there is a possibility there might be a trial that will identify an abnormality that's found.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Sessions, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, I agree 100%. I think for the treatment that she's on currently, that was absolutely appropriate, that the testing that she's had, but it was sort of the next question in terms of clinical trials, looking for actionable mutations, that might be something worth looking into. But I agree with Dr. Benson's response.
And so, Joseph, I hope this is helpful to you and that you'll take us back to your treating healthcare team, and hopefully this, I'm glad you got to ask this question. Thank you. And now we do have some questions from our online participants, so I'm going to start with this question, which I'm going to address to Dr. Benson. The question is, my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer at age 65 despite regular colonoscopies. My father also had repeated episodes of colon cancer, initially diagnosed in his 40s. I'm concerned for my son, age 26, since he has it on both sides. At what age should he be tested, and should it be something more than colonoscopies? So, Dr. Benson, would you be able to address it in a general way?
So I generally recommend for a situation such as this that people see a genetic counselor who will sit down and do a very careful review of the family history and then determine if it would be beneficial to take a blood test to see if, in fact, there's a germline mutation. If there is a inherited colon cancer identified, or risk of developing an inherited colon cancer, then advice would be given as to how frequently to evaluate an individual, including colonoscopies. With Lynch syndrome, for people in their 20s, we're doing colonoscopies often on a yearly basis. But I think the first step to get a very careful review of the family history would be with genetic counseling.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Sirsak, did you want to add anything? Or?
No, I agree with Dr. Benson's response. I think in the absence of any genetic links being identified, the standard recommendation per NCCN guidelines is for a screening colonoscopy 10 years younger than the affected patient. We sometimes push that out even a bit more, but that may not be covered by insurance.
So, okay, so that's really important information to have here. And actually, Ms. Edlin, do you want to comment on the on this in terms of cost issues that might impact people's decisions about perhaps the treatment that they might be recommended for them?
Yes. So I think it sometimes at various points in either the diagnostic or the treatment process, people are facing financial issues and questions. And I guess I would just add that we at Cancer Care can be a resource for that. We offer our own limited financial assistance, but in many cases we are happy to provide resource referrals as we hear a little bit more about what someone or their family is navigating. And I can imagine that especially in approaching some of these questions from a preventative standpoint, there are a lot of questions to consider. So I do think it's important to reach out to resources like Cancer Care because we are here to help and we're here to offer some ideas. And so I would always encourage someone to call our 800 number.
Excellent. Because sometimes we have resources or we're aware of resources because that's what we spend our lives really getting all that information. And so we might be able to help if that was an issue of cost. And so that would be true for everyone on the call to think of contacting us around those issues. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Edlund. And our next online question comes from, I'm going to give this question to Dr. Sirsak. Do you have any information on treatment of medullary adenocarcinoma of the right colon? Also, what is the outlook for someone diagnosed with this rare form of colon cancer?
So I think the question is regarding medullary adenocarcinoma. So often the medullary subtype is associated with the genetic predisposition or Lynch syndrome, and that is commonly found on the right side of the colon as well. And those are the tumors that we discussed earlier tend to have the numerous mutations or the microsatellite instability or MSI high tumors. So for these patients in general, in metastatic disease, systemic chemotherapy is, of course, an option. We can choose from the treatments that are standard and have been approved. But immunotherapy here is certainly an option with PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors, and they have been studied in later lines of therapy and shown to be beneficial for patients, but based on the efficacy seen in these MSI-high tumors, we have the NCCN guidelines now also support the use of immunotherapy up front, meaning in first or second line therapy. There are also a number of ongoing clinical trials looking at treatment in combination with immunotherapy for earlier stage disease as well, so sort of in the preventative setting.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Benson, do you want to add to that as well?
Oh, no, I totally agree.
Okay. And then we have another question actually from Ms. Bearden. Do you have any information on treatment of – I'm sorry, let me any opinion on ketogenic diet for colorectal cancers? Ms. Bearden, can you comment on that?
Mm-hmm. I can. There's not currently a practice utilizing the ketogenic diet. I know there's a lot of information out there about different types of diet, but what we do know is in following guidelines through the American Institute of Cancer Research and the American Society for Cancer, it's all of those guidelines is what we know through evidence-based research or what we can, ethically discuss with patients and have seen some proven and repetitive benefit. And the diet that what that looks like is, a plant-based diet. Now, modifying that diet based on side effects that you may be experiencing due to treatment, that can be worked with your healthcare team. But as of now, no, I can't say that's a diet that would be recommended.
And can you just say what that is so people just know what that word means?
The keto, you mean the plant-based diet?
No, the ketogenic, what does that?
Oh, the ketogenic. So basically, it's a high-fat diet, and there's protein also. There's very little carbohydrate, so it puts your body in a different state of metabolizing a different nutrient-based and more of a fat-based energy source than the simple carbohydrate, the carbohydrate as our energy source.
Excellent, okay. Mm-hmm. And I have another question, thank you so much, for Dr. Benson. So here's his question. So my brother has metastatic colon cancer, diagnosed at age 45, no family history, no specific genetic link determined as of now. He had a liver resection. Unfortunately, the tumors have returned, as he is also a vegan. Any tips on diet that can help him during his treatment? He will begin immunotherapy soon.
Well, I think, as alluded to, we don't have specific components of a diet outside of what you heard very nicely presented that we would recommend. We want to make sure that people are getting the calories they need, that they're well hydrated, and unless one of my colleagues has further suggestions, that's pretty much what we focus on. And if there's concern, I certainly refer people to one of our nutritionists to go over what they're eating, what they like, how they can maximize their calories and their hydration.
Excellent. Ms. Bearden, sounds like you would probably agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thank you. And our last late-breaking question for Dr. Benson. What are the pros and cons of 5-FU being by infusion versus the in form of pills? My husband's port was pulled due to a possible infection. He is now taking Xeloda by pill. Could you address this in a general way, Dr. Benson?
Yes. There have been a number of clinical trials, actually across GI cancers, not just colorectal cancer, looking at infusional 5-FU versus Xeloda, also known as capecitabine, and we consider them equivalent. And so often 5-FU or capecitabine is combined with, for example, oxaliplatin, and either combination is fine, or if given as a single agent, either is fine. They give equivalent results. With capecitabine, you may see a little more hand and foot syndrome, for example, and that has to be monitored carefully. If people have a decrease in their kidney function, you have to be careful in looking at the dose of capecitabine. For the elderly, sometimes we have to make adjustments, but either is fine.
Thank you so much. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. You can't hear us all applauding you, but we are. It was just an amazing presentation, quite a really tour de force. Thank you. And I also want to thank all of our participants who asked really such excellent questions, both on the telephone and online. A very involved audience today. Lots of excellent questions. We have many more that we actually were not able to get to. So I want to start with getting to any of you who have questions, medical questions particularly that you didn't quite get answered. I want to be sure to cover that. So if you have any medical questions that you still are holding on to, of course your healthcare team is always your go-to team to go to. But if some of you want to get credible information to help inform your questions even more so before you go to your healthcare team, then I would suggest you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And again, that information will be sent out to all of you as well. Or you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And indeed, both for people in the U.S. and international participants, they do have a live chat feature where you can post your question, and one of the information specialists will get back to you with lots of information that would be very helpful to you. Now, in addition, I had mentioned that we are partnering with two colorectal organizations, the Colon Cancer Alliance and Fight Colorectal Cancer, and they also have, of course, a call center that you can call into and to get additional information and websites, and you'll be getting that information also. If you would like to contact Cancer Care for any of our services, whether they be practical or financial assistance, to talk with one of our social workers, join one of our support groups, order one of our publications, visit our website, participate in one of our upcoming workshops, then I would suggest you just contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673, really for those supportive services that can make all the difference in the world in really your coping with colorectal cancer, with any cancer. And most importantly, as we're about to conclude the program, we don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone. We want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. I also want to remind all of you that we have many more programs coming up, and there is a very exciting program that we're planning. It's a 5-part series called Life with Cancer, and it starts on May 3rd, and many of you may be getting the brochures or information about those programs, and I think that there's something in there for each of you, and so I do encourage you to participate in those programs as well. And we will be doing another colorectal program actually probably toward the end of June, so stay tuned. It'll be after ASCO, and so there'll be more information yet in addition to what you got today. So thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.